know how unpopular their agenda is. So instead of running on their record, they're trying to rig the system.
Democrats are speaking out against a Republican-led effort in Texas to redraw the state's congressional map.
For Friday, August 22nd, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Federal tax credits for electric vehicles expire on September 30th.
But turns out buyers don't need to have the car delivered by then to get the credit.
What I can tell you is for the people that know the vehicle they want, this added flexibility will make a meaningful difference to them.
Also, we speak to the lead singer of Deftones.
The alternative metal band is still experimenting with their sound.
It's a cohesive piece of work, but it has variety in there. And I think we knew we had a record when all those elements were sort of present.
Now news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Herbst. As soldiers and federal agents patrol Washington, D.C., President Trump suggested that he would send federal resources to Chicago. NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben reports Trump also mentioned other cities where he would consider sending personnel.
With J.D. Vance at his side, Trump called Chicago a mess.
And the people in Chicago, Mr. Vice President, are screaming for us to come. They're wearing red hats, just like this one. But they're wearing red hats. African-American ladies, beautiful ladies, are saying, please, President Trump, come to Chicago.
He later added that he hasn't taken concrete steps for this plan. Trump also suggested sending personnel to San Francisco and New York. Under the D.C. Home Rule Act, a president can take control of the city's police for 30 days in cases of emergency, after which Congress would be needed to extend that time frame. However, the president does not have similar powers over other cities. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, The White House.
The Justice Department has released transcripts of a recent interview with the former girlfriend of deceased sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports on new details from Ghislaine Maxwell, who's serving a 20-year prison sentence.
Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche traveled to Florida this summer to conduct an unusual interview with Maxwell. He released the transcripts on social media and what he called the interest of transparency. Maxwell told DOJ she may have met now President Trump because he was friendly with her father. She also called Trump a gentleman in all respects. The president's allies have been clamoring to see the Justice Department's files on Jeffrey Epstein in case they reveal new information about the source of his wealth and his sex trafficking of underage girls. David Marcus, a lawyer for Maxwell, says she told the truth and that she's a scapegoat. After her interview, Maxwell was moved into a less restrictive federal prison in Texas. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Kilmar Abrego Garcia has been released from a jail in Tennessee and will be back in Maryland for the first time since he was wrongly deported to El Salvador in March. Mariana Bacallao from member station WPLN has more.
Kilmar Abrego Garcia faces human smuggling charges stemming from a 2022 traffic stop in Tennessee, where he's been held in custody since the Supreme Court mandated his return to the U.S. For now, Abrego Garcia's lawyers have confirmed that he was en route to reunite with his family in Maryland. It's not clear how long he'll be able to stay there, though. Federal immigration officials have warned that he could still be deported before his trial in January. For NPR News, I'm Mariana Bacallao in Nashville.
Wall Street sharply higher by the closing bell, the Dow up 846 points. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The FBI today searched the Maryland home and D.C. office of President Trump's former national security advisor, now a critic of the president. John Bolton served in Trump's first term. The FBI says it conducted a court-authorized activity in the area without giving further comment. Sources tell NPR that the search was tied to Bolton's handling of classified documents. The White House released a list of specific art exhibits and live events at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. that it finds unacceptable. NPR's Anastasia Siloukas reports the unsigned memo from the White House is titled, President Trump is Right About the Smithsonian.
The memo lists 22 specific items and events across six Smithsonian museums that the Trump administration considers objectionable. It also criticizes the yet-to-be-built American Women's History Museum. The memo does not specify any course of action that the White House plans to take. The list includes an exhibition of Afrofuturistic work by artist Ayanna V. Jackson at the Museum of African Art. Another is a video made for the National Portrait Gallery by the artist Hugo Crosthwaite. It portrays Dr. Anthony Fauci, the infectious disease expert who frequently went head-to-head with the president during the COVID-19 pandemic. The Smithsonian declined to comment in response. Anastasia Tsoulikas, NPR News, New York.
And I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include AEG Presents, with Loive live in concert on her A Matter of Time tour, performing this fall at arenas across the country. More information is at amatteroftimetour.com.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. We receive support from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. This weekend on Stay Human, we'll hear about a pop-up art show that happened last week, Words as Buried Seeds. We'll hear from the organizers and others about the scene, Saturday morning at 9 and Sunday at 5.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. This week, the country's two most populous states each took another step toward reshaping the national political landscape. President Trump initiated a redistricting arms race when he urged Texas to redraw its congressional map to boost Republicans. And now, in response, California leaders are going to ask their state's voters to approve a new map, one that helps Democrats. Today, we wanted to take a step back and talk about all of that and about power and democracy. So we're joined now by NPR voting correspondents Miles Parks and Ashley Lopez. Hi to both of you.
Hey there.
Hey.
Ashley, I'll start with you. Can you just get us up to speed on the latest about redistricting?
Yeah, sure. So the two big states to watch in all this, Texas and California, have passed legislation this week. In Texas, the Republican-led state legislature is on the verge of sending a new congressional map to the governor for approval. This new map creates five more favorable seats for the GOP, which is what President Trump asked for. And in response to Texas, the Democratic-led California legislature has approved legislation that would put a ballot measure before voters this November that would ask for their approval for California to basically do the same thing. Governor Gavin Newsom has signed the legislation, which means the race is on now to convince voters over the next 2 months to approve that ballot measure.
And do I understand correctly that other states are also looking at doing this?
Yeah, that's right. And I'm going to start with Ohio. That is a Republican-led state that actually has to draw new maps this year because of some quirkiness with their redistricting process. Republican leaders in Florida, Missouri, and Indiana have also all signaled that they plan to redraw their congressional maps as well. And we are seeing more Democratic and left-leaning groups urge blue states to counter with their own redistricting plans. But a number of Democratic states, I should say, have rules that make it harder for them to gerrymander for partisan gains, especially mid-decade like this.
Got it. Miles, Ashley mentioned gerrymandering when voting maps are purposely manipulated, which has, of course, been around for a while. It's not new. So help us understand, how is what we're seeing happening right now different?
Right. I mean, gerrymandering has been around basically as long as America has. But there was a definite turning point, specifically in 2019. That year, the Supreme Court ruled that federal courts could not stop states from partisan gerrymandering. And even at that time, experts said, essentially, this would rip open the floodgates to this sort of manipulation. The guardrails were essentially ripped off. But it's also clear that this is part of a broader trend from President Trump pushing against the limits of democracy when it comes to consolidating power. I was talking yesterday with Senator Alex Padilla, who's a Democrat from California. Here's how he put it.
They know their agenda is so unpopular, their only hope of holding on to power is to rig the election. I mean, when I heard the find me five more seats, Republican seats in Texas, it sounded a lot like find me 11,000 more votes in Georgia after he lost the 2020 election.
He's, of course, referring to the phone call that Trump made to the Secretary of State of Georgia in 2020. And it's important to note this is not just maps and redrawing them. We're seeing the Trump White House push the boundaries of federal power in all sorts of federal or all sorts of election policy, I should say. Earlier this week, he hinted at an executive order that would be coming soon that potentially could try to curb mail voting and also curb the use of some voting machines, though we haven't seen the text of that order yet.
Okay, let's stay on the executive order for a second. President Trump spoke about this during a news conference, and he was explicit about his partisan goals, that he wants to get rid of voting by mail because it is, quote, the only way Democrats get elected. Let's listen.
That's bigger than anything having to do with redistricting, believe me. And the Republicans have to get smart. We're not going to have a country. I said for a long time at rallies, you need borders and you need free and fair elections.
Ashley Lopez, if you can, just help us put this planned executive order into context.
Sure. So Donald Trump obviously has a long history at this point of casting doubt on the legitimacy of elections before people actually vote, and especially mail-in ballots. And just for some fact-checking, there is not a widespread problem with security and reliability of voting by mail. We just had an election last year that Donald Trump won that included the widespread use of mail ballots. And what's important to note here is that Trump actually doesn't have the legal authority to tell states how to run their elections. The Constitution is very clear about this, but despite that, voting rights advocates say this is a way for Trump to destabilize our elections and cast doubt on the legitimacy of the midterm election results.
I mean, speaking of the midterm results and those ballots, Miles Parks, how might voters see these efforts to manipulate election results?
I mean, Juana, for a long time, the political wisdom was that voters hated this sort of when politicians change rules specifically to benefit themselves. Mm-hmm. But it's important to remember that we're living in this sort of post-2024 reality, right? Donald Trump won the popular vote last year after trying to overturn a fair election in 2020. A plurality of Americans either said, I don't care that he did that, I don't mind that he did that, or I don't believe that he did that. So it's really unclear at this point how voters are going to feel about these other sort of actions to manipulate the system. And also, because there were no political ramifications for Trump's behavior in 2020, it makes sense that other politicians are suddenly a little bit more open to pushing the boundaries on democracy as well.
And I should say, in that same election, we also saw like various reform efforts in states across the country fail. Most of these efforts, by the way, were aimed at making our politics less partisan, which is something voters have long said they want. And I do think this ballot measure in California, though, will give us a good sense of how voters actually feel about skirting some good government rules to benefit a political party.
NPR voting correspondents Ashley Lopez and Miles Parks, thanks to both of you.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you.
Hurricane Katrina flooded nearly every building in St. Bernard Parish, east of New Orleans. 20 years after the storm, oil and sugar refineries are back, but the population has not recovered. NPR's Jeff Brady reported from St. Bernard Parish back in 2005, and earlier this month, he returned and found that the sprawling, blue-collar, coastal community is still rebuilding.
When I first met Kevin Potter in December of 2005, he was at his brother's house, which was being rebuilt.
We had about 2.5 to 3 feet of water.
20 years ago, Potter also planned to rebuild his flooded home, but only if two things happened. He wanted the Mississippi River Gulf outlet closed. That's a shipping channel known as the Mr. Go that brought Katrina's storm surge into the parish.
The Mr. Go has got to be closed or a gate. Some type of device has to be installed. We have to correct the levees.
The Mr. Go was closed and a 22-mile levee system built around St. Bernard Parish, part of a regional $14.5 billion federally funded flood protection system. So today, Potter is back.
Hi there.
Hello, Mr. Jeff. Haven't
Good
seen
to
you
see
in a while.
20 years.
Potter catches me up. His family lived in a FEMA trailer in their yard for 2 years after Katrina. He was laid off from his oil refinery job. And now, at 71 years old, he worries about the cost of flood insurance.
And we're still fooling with the house. You know, we almost have about 90%.
The living room floor is bare concrete, and the back wall still needs a brick exterior installed. Rebuilding was more expensive than he imagined, and his wife's daycare business was the first priority.
I built the daycare center. I had all the receipts, and I doubled them. I doubled it when I made an estimate, and everything was coming back triple.
In this politically conservative community, people don't connect more intense storms like Katrina to climate change, as scientists do. Still, for many, the cost to rebuild and the risk of future storms was too much. They left and never returned. U.S. Census data show the parish population dropped from over 71,000 people before Katrina to about 45,000 as of last year. Mark Benfatti was among those who left. He owns a construction company an hour's drive away in Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. This is a change for Benfatti. He owned four restaurants in St. Bernard Parish, but they all flooded along with his home.
I had 3 feet of water on my second floor, so I think I estimated 12 to 13 feet of water inside of our house in St. Bernard.
Benfatti says the parish is only a few feet above sea level, but his current neighborhood is on higher ground.
Where I'm at now, it's going to take 22 feet of water before it even gets in my house. I just think that's a little bit better chance.
St. Bernard Parish President Louis Pomez says many residents left after the storm because there were no schools, healthcare facilities, and grocery stores.
I mean, for 3 months, you couldn't spend a copper penny in St. Bernard Parish. There was nowhere to spend money. There was nothing in operation.
Drive through the parish now, and there's more green space, gaps in neighborhoods where houses used to stand. The population has changed, too. There are fewer white residents and more Black and Latino people. That's despite a parish ordinance that homeowners could only rent to blood relatives. A judge ruled that was illegal discrimination, and the law was rescinded. Pomez says that was a costly legal fight for the parish, and now his focus is on attracting new residents.
That would be really awesome if we can get at least another 20,000 more residents in St. Bernard Parish.
With a rebuilt hospital, new schools, and a campaign to attract more businesses, Pomez is optimistic. So is 22-year-old Belle Landry, who works at her family's store and restaurant.
Like any New Orleans restaurant, we have red beans on Monday.
Landry was 2 years old when Katrina hit. Her family returned to St. Bernard Parish as soon as they could and later bought this business.
And I love the culture here, the people. They definitely have like a resilient spirit.
Residents hope that eventually will bring their community fully back, 20 years after Hurricane Katrina. Jeff Brady, NPR News, St. Bernard Parish, Louisiana.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station. This is NPR. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is your Daily Dose of Phenology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from this date. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, announcing the release of the new Fall Stinger Variety Pack, featuring the Blood Orange IPA and Lemon Drop Blonde. Available in liquor stores now. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Now it's time for your Daily Dose of Phenology.
On today's date, August 22nd, 1984, I see my first ever bobcat in the wild. Bobcats are remarkably stealthy and seldom are seen out in the open. This one dashed across the road in front of me and left an irreplaceable image in my head of a large cat, short tail, somewhat the color of a deer, kind of grayish-reddish, and moving very quickly. In the intervening years, trail cams have become very popular across northern Minnesota, well, and across the country in general, and one of the repeated images seen on trail cams are bobcats. They're much more ubiquitous than we ever thought. There seem to be bobcats behind every tree and under every pile of rocks. And the trail cam has brought it out to all of us. But they are very stealthy and mostly running around at night, so we seldom see them, and any sound that we would make would tip them off in a hurry to get the heck out of there. So not many get seen, but there are many around.
NPR comes from this station and from Subaru, who, along with its retailers, is partnering with AdoptAClassroom.org to provide funding to high-need schools and local communities for the Subaru Loves Learning Initiative. Subaru, more than a car company. From Odoo, maker of business management software, with the goal of promoting growth and scaling businesses with efficiency. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. 5 years ago this week, the leader of the Russian opposition movement, Alexei Navalny, was poisoned with a nerve agent developed by a secret lab in Moscow. Although he survived and recovered in Germany, Navalny was imprisoned upon returning to Russia and died in an Arctic penal colony last February. Well, now that multiple countries are talking about negotiating an end to Russia's war in Ukraine, where does the Russian opposition movement stand today? That is a question we're going to put to Mikhail Fishman, a host with the independent Russian news outlet TV Rain. He joins us now from Amsterdam, where he is currently based. Welcome.
Hi, yes, thank you for having me.
Let me ask you. Since Alexei Navalny's death, who has emerged as the leader of the opposition now? Anyone in particular?
Navalny's death has been more than a loss for Russian opposition. Russia's democratic project is over for many years for now. It was over even before the war started. But there was hope, and this hope that Russia can return to democracy, that Russia can join the club of civilized nations, that everything can be okay and fine. The bearer of this hope was Navalny. He had this moral authority. He reinvented how to do politics of protesting. He created his own base. Hope and expectations were with him.
Well, then, if hope and expectations lived and died with Alexei Navalny, how much agreement is there now within the Russian opposition movement on other policy aims beyond simply standing against Putin's authoritarian government?
We should talk about resistance rather than of opposition. But now it doesn't have this guiding light. His camp, his team has become the target for attacks from within the opposition. It just represents the whole disarray and deflation that Russian opposition finds itself in now.
Yes, I want to talk about that disarray because I noted you are physically in Amsterdam. And yeah, most opposition parties and independent media have had to leave Russia. How much are messages that are critical of the Putin regime even being heard inside Russia now, especially as crackdowns on dissent have intensified after Russia's invasion of Ukraine?
Well, that's a very good question. And Putin's regime has been quite efficient in censorship and silencing the voices from the outside. The YouTube is basically down in Russia. Now they are on the brink of shutting down WhatsApp and Telegram, and we expect it to happen really soon. It's already started happening, but not to the degree that they expected. And we see it by our own numbers, by data for our own broadcasts in YouTube. We see that we still have quite a significant audience in Russia. I personally, or my colleagues from TV Rain or other journalistic teams, are targeted on basically weekly basis by Russian propaganda. And that means that we still matter.
Well, now that there is some international momentum to negotiate an end to the war in Ukraine, do you think the opposition has more leverage now in calling for things like the freeing of political prisoners as part of some international prisoner exchange deal?
I would say the only issue that has been brought to the table by Russian resistance, Russian opposition, Russian human rights watchers, and this is the fate of political prisoners. And the most prominent voice here is the voice of Dmitry Muratov, editor of Novaya Gazeta and Nobel Peace Prize laureate. He appeals for months during every phase of these negotiations. He appeals to all the sides of the conflict, including Washington, to add the release of political prisoners to the agenda of these negotiations between Russia and Ukraine. It's actually a joint effort of human rights watchers in Ukraine as well as in Russia to bring political prisoners' fate to the negotiating table.
Mikhail Fishman, host with the independent Russian news outlet TV Rain, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
What was supposed to be a return trip to New York City for international tourists visiting Niagara Falls abruptly ended in tragedy today when a tour bus crashed and rolled over on a highway near Buffalo. Ryan Zenner of member station Buffalo Toronto Public Media joins us from the scene. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
Ryan, what details can you tell us about this accident?
Yeah, so the immediate belief from New York State Police is that the tour bus hit a median and overcorrected, causing the incident. 52 individuals were confirmed to be aboard the bus. The accident happened shortly before 1 p.m. today. Police think some were not wearing seatbelts. Some passengers were ejected through the windows, others pinned and had to be rescued from that rollover crash. The bus ended up landing on its side. In a press conference, New York State Police say they believe several people were killed, including one child, but they've yet to provide a definitive number.
Anything you can tell us about the victims? Who were the passengers on this bus?
Yeah, Juana. So the bus was carrying tourists from Niagara Falls to New York City. Police say they're mostly from China, India, and the Philippines. Translators had to be called on site to assist in the emergency effort and the later medical care efforts, which are still underway. Police say the driver of the bus is alive and is cooperating with an investigation. New York State Police say they'll access footage from the bus to figure out what exactly happened before that crash and during it.
Anything you can tell us about the status of the people there who were injured?
Yeah, so patients were sent to two area hospitals, one in Rochester, one in Buffalo. That Buffalo hospital said 24 people were taken in there, many with head injuries, fractures, and two currently undergoing surgery, but they are expected to survive. Victims were transported to medical facilities by ambulances, and several rushed by medical helicopters. Erie County Medical Center's chief medical officer, Dr. Samuel Cloud, said this is a mass casualty event for the hospital.
ECMC is the only adult level one trauma center for Western New York. We plan, we train, and we are prepared to implement our plans for mass casualty incidents, which we proved today. We rapidly evaluated 24 patients from this incident this afternoon.
And a local blood bank also issuing an emergency appeal for blood donations on social media due to this crash. The accident shut down Interstate 90 in both directions, much of that stretch continuing to be closed and causing major detours and traffic incidences around that section of the Interstate 90. New York Governor Kathy Hochul expressed sympathy for those killed and injured in the crash. She also said she'll commit resources available for first responders. This is Ryan Zenner from Buffalo, Toronto, Public Media.
Ryan Zenner, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. We receive support from the Watermark Arts Center in downtown Bemidji with exhibits, classes, and handcrafted original art made by regional artists found in their shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public. WatermarkArtsCenter.org. Tickets are now on sale for Hadestown, now through August 25th at the Mask and Rose Women's Theater in Popovsky. The musical follows intertwined love stories from Greek mythology in a stylized underworld. Tickets are only available in advance at McKenzie Place in Bemidji. We receive support from Hibbing Chrysler Center, serving the Northland for over 25 years on the Beltline in Hibbing. Their service center provides regular maintenance and major auto repairs weekdays from 7:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. More details online at hibbingchrysler.us.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Some groups are sounding the alarm on potential scams that target people who are exposed to radiation linked to U.S. nuclear weapons, including Native Americans. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Yvette Fernandez reports, Congress approved and expanded funding to help the victims.
It was a big win for victims of radiation exposure when the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act was renewed and expanded to cover more states. Victims in Utah, New Mexico, Idaho, and parts of Nevada and Arizona are among those who can seek compensation. But many people find it difficult to qualify. That's because necessary documentation from the Cold War era is decades old, says Carmen Valdez with the nonprofit Health and Environment Alliance of Utah.
These funds are meant to help ease people's pain and suffering and to cover medical bills and to ensure they're not suffering financially while also suffering from these diseases and cancers.
That's where scammers are finding opportunities. Valdez says some companies are charging fees up to three times the allowable $2,000. It comes as deadlines for claims approach in December of 2027, when the program is slated to end. I'm Yvette Fernandez.
Vaccination rates are declining across Washington state, and experts say this leaves Native communities vulnerable to dangerous disease outbreaks, especially heading back to school. Isabel Charlet reports.
According to the Washington State Department of Health, there have been 10 confirmed cases of measles in Washington in three counties this year. Wendy Stevens is with the American Indian Health Commission, which formed the nation's first tribal immunization coalition. She cites data showing that the measles vaccine reduces people's chance of getting the disease by 97%.
Getting measles immunization protects not only you, but your family, your community from spreading measles.
Vaccination rates have dropped to 87% among kindergartners in Washington. This is well below the 95% threshold needed to prevent outbreaks, according to the Washington Health Alliance. While most measles infections are not severe, health complications can occur in about 30% of cases, with about 1 in 1,000 infections leading to death. Stevens adds people need to stay up to date on what is happening with outbreaks in their area and advises getting any questions about vaccines answered by a doctor.
I would encourage people in Indian Country to connect to their tribal health clinic, talk to their providers, and they can make decisions that they feel good about for their family.
As of May, the U.S. has reported over 1,000 measles cases, a 400% increase from last year, with almost all involving unvaccinated people. I'm Isabel Charlet.
The Southern Indian Ute Tribe in Colorado says it has not entered into any agreement with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, regarding detention operations. The tribe issued a statement this week to clarify its position after recent news reports listed the tribe as potential ICE facility sites. In a press release, the tribe said it was not notified nor consulted prior to the release of information regarding detention operations, and says there have been no discussions between the tribal council and federal authorities on the matter. In Oklahoma, Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. signed the tribe's first artificial intelligence policy Thursday. It establishes new guidelines for AI use across all Cherokee Nation departments. The policy outlines specific approved uses and strictly prohibits AI use without quality review involving the Cherokee language, which must receive backing and incorporation from Cherokee fluent speakers. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from AirTalk Wireless, where individuals who qualify for the Tribal Lifeline program receive an iPhone or Samsung device, unlimited data, calls and texts, and international calling. Learn more at airtalkwireless.com/NNN.
Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at aarp.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. The people of northern Gaza are starving. That is the official declaration of a United Nations-backed group of experts who comprise the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC. According to the report, the famine is entirely man-made, and one-third of Gaza's population is expected to experience catastrophic levels of hunger by the end of next month. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that there is no famine in Gaza and that food shortages there are the result of Hamas seizing aid shipments. Jean-Martin Bauer is the Director of Food Security and Nutrition Analysis for the World Food Program. He joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
We have been hearing news about food shortages in Gaza for months now. So just start by telling us, what is different right now that leads the IPC to officially call this a famine?
So today's IPC findings confirm that famine is not just a risk in Gaza. It's become a reality in the case of Gaza City. Now, the IPC's formally confirmed that a famine is taking place, and this only takes place when three critical thresholds are met. Mm-hmm. The first one is extreme food deprivation. The second is acute malnutrition rates. And the third is the level of starvation-related deaths. Now, all three have now been breached in Gaza City, and that means that there's massive starvation, destitution, and death. What the report also says is that these conditions could also expand and cover two more governorates in Gaza, Deir al-Balah and Khan Yunis. And this is within the next few weeks.
As we mentioned, a number of leaders in Israel, including Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, have said famine is not there, food shortages are due to Hamas stealing food. Your response to that?
Look, if we look at extreme food deprivation, the data we have shows that very severe hunger has tripled in Gaza governorate, which includes Gaza City, since this is between May and July. For malnutrition among children, it's accelerating at a catastrophic pace. Malnutrition levels in Gaza City have tripled between May and July. And what experts are saying is that collapsing health system, untreated illness, and the surge in child disease are pushing death rates higher. This is the IPC. These findings were reviewed by a group of independent experts called the Famine Review Committee. They looked at everything in detail, and they are telling us today that there is a famine taking place in Gaza governorate, which includes Gaza City, and that it could spread. The IPC is the gold standard in terms of international food security analysis.
You've underscored that a famine declaration is significant, but if Israel refuses to let aid into Gaza, and if countries like the United States do not find ways to hold Israel accountable, what will actually change for the people there in northern Gaza who you say are at a tipping point right now?
Well, addressing famine in Gaza will require not only food, but also urgent medical support, emergency nutrition. And what actually we've seen in the history of this crisis is that when there is a ceasefire, conditions do improve. If we go back to the month of February, food prices in Gaza had gone way down. The same indicators that we've been monitoring since the start of this crisis were a lot better than they are today. So when humanitarians are given a chance to respond, the situation does improve. The problem in the present scenario of famine in Gaza City is that we have this exponential increase in acute malnutrition, which is extremely complex to treat. And once you're in these uncharted waters, it's not as easy as just letting trucks in. That malnutrition takes weeks to treat. It's a slow burn. And unfortunately, that's been triggered already. And this is a new facet to a very complex crisis in Gaza.
Look ahead to us now that this declaration of famine has occurred, to what might come next for the people there in Gaza and what they're experiencing.
The people in Gaza are experiencing a prolonged food crisis, which started in 2023 with moments where things got better, including the ceasefire I mentioned earlier this year. And what we hopefully see is conditions on the ground improving for humanitarian actors, improving for the health sector, and that would only happen with an end to the hostilities. The situation right now is appalling, and the fact that a famine has been confirmed today should call us all to act. This is, in the words of the emergency coordinator of the UN, a stain on our conscience.
I do want to ask you what you've been hearing from your people there on the ground as they work to provide resources to people there. What are they saying to you?
They're saying that there's a desperation, that they see malnourished children on the ground. It's also a very difficult time for the humanitarians trying to bring assistance.
We've been speaking with Jean-Martin Bauer. He's the Director of Food Security and Nutrition Analysis for the World Food Program. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The federal tax credit for electric vehicles is expiring on September 30th, but the IRS just announced a little bit of wiggle room. It turns out that buyers don't need to have the car delivered by then to get the credit. NPR's Camila Domonoski reports.
The One Big Beautiful Bill Act made a lot of changes to the tax code, including one that caught the attention of car dealers, as you can hear in ads from around the nation.
Thinking about making the switch to an electric vehicle? Well, now's the time, because the $7,500
in IRS money that comes off
$7,500 on brand new vehicles and up to $4,000 on used vehicles is going away September 30th.
Those were Facebook videos from Elko Cadillac, Williams Chevrolet, and Van Horn Automotive emphasizing the September 30th deadline to get thousands off an electric vehicle. Now, about that deadline.
Generally, to claim the credit, you need to have purchased and taken possession of the vehicle by the termination date.
Andy Phillips is the vice president of the Tax Institute at H&R Block.
However, this week the IRS released guidance indicating that the credit will
The news allowed. From the IRS is that you don't need to take possession of the vehicle by September 30th. If you sign a binding contract and put some money down by the deadline, like a down payment or a trade-in, then you can get the tax credit, even if you don't get the keys until later. Phillips says that will help people who are eyeing a car that's in another state, or maybe they want a vehicle custom built. Folks who can do the paperwork now but can't actually get the vehicle delivered in time.
I can't give you exact numbers of how many people will now be able to take advantage of this credit, but what I can tell you is for the people that know the vehicle they want, this added flexibility will make a meaningful difference to them.
Because the credits are not small. They're worth up to $7,500 on qualifying new cars and $4,000 on used cars, as long as buyers are under income caps. They're also available without restrictions on leases for any kind of EV. The looming end of the credits has pushed EV sales up this summer, but Jessica Caldwell, head of insights at the car data site Edmunds, says she has not seen searches for EVs increase, at least not as much as she would have expected.
I think the big thing is awareness, because I don't think a lot of consumers are necessarily aware this is happening.
Between constant updates on tariffs and other car-related headlines, she suspects some people just haven't realized that these hefty incentives are about to go away. Mila Domonoski, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered here on People Powered Radio, KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. There's a local drive for the National Morrow Donor Program from 5 to 7 at the Grand Rapids Dairy Queen. Healthy individuals ages 18 to 35 can get their cheeks swabbed at the event and register to possibly save a life. Sometimes the only hope for a cure comes from an unrelated donor. You can also join the registry by texting Cure Cancer Today without spaces to 61474. Headwaters Music and Arts in Bemidji hosts a drum workshop and circle jam today from 5:30 to 8:30. It's free and open to those ages 10 and up. Learn from two renowned teachers of West African drumming. The Edge Center Gallery in Big Fork presents Art on the Edge, their 19th annual juried exhibit during the month of August. Now it's time for North Star Stories here on KAXE-KBXE.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
Today, a legal victory for Twin City tenants who receive housing vouchers. Then, homeowners react to the new homeowner association laws. And a Northeast marina celebrates long-term upgrades. I'm Gracie J. The Minnesota Supreme Court upheld a Minneapolis ordinance banning landlords from discriminating against tenants who receive housing vouchers. The Housing Choice Voucher Program helps low-income families pay for housing. Minneapolis passed the ordinance in 2017, but several landlords sued, claiming it was unconstitutional. The court ruled against the landlords, finding the city does not owe them payment. The ordinance has support from groups including the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, the Housing Justice Center, and the Attorney General. Tenants outside Minneapolis are not covered by the ordinance. In today's main story, new homeowner association laws grant new protections, but some homeowners still have concerns about how much the new law will help them. Kylie Kendall with more.
I have certainly uncovered what I think is just kind of an insidious industry.
Roxanne Williams lives in an HOA in Otsego, northwest of the Twin Cities. One fall day a few years back, she received a notice from her HOA board.
And all of a sudden, we were told we need new roofs. What the heck is going on here? Our roofs are beautiful. Well, what in the world is this all about?
She was told a replacement was needed because of storm damage.
And there was no damage, and I took photos of it. I've got photos to this day. It's beautiful condition.
That's when Roxanne decided to investigate. She found the contract of the roofing deal was initiated a week before the storm even hit.
It was shocking to me. That told me there's something wrong here. Something is going on.
Roxanne reached out to her property manager to ask about the contract, but was redirected to the HOA's attorney.
And I thought, if you did nothing wrong, then why are you getting an attorney involved?
The attorney never answered a question about the roofing contract. She then received a shocking fee.
Here's an extra $700 and some added to my account. And the only thing it said was something like, attorney bill forward.
She asked for an invoice, but only received more fees and a warning. If she didn't pay them, they could foreclose her home.
It's just dirty. It's just so dirty.
Roxanne is just one of the many homeowners having issues with their HOA leadership.
Then we got a new board. It got to be more authoritarian.
Sherry Marcy has been living in her Arden Hills HOA, northeast of the Twin Cities, for 8 years.
I've received 3 violation notices.
Sherry received these notices after posting her concerns about the leadership on their community message boards.
The second one I put up was about the assessments, and that was a major concern to everybody.
Her new HOA board was amending their rules to let the board raise homeowners' monthly fees by 15% without approval from owners.
And they assured us, don't worry, they won't raise it exorbitantly because they'd have to pay it too. And I thought to myself, well, then don't put it in.
But they lost the vote and the board approved the 15% increase. Sherry says she was in favor of the HOA reform bill, which included 41 recommendations, like getting rid of excessive fines and setting conflict of interest standards, but only one passed, the creation of the ombudsperson.
And there were a whole raft we were so excited about.
Mark Foster, the vice president of HOA Leadership Network, said more transparency would be good for HOA boards.
Shining sunlight on issues, especially board issues, is always good.
But he also said they feel the bill is egregious and not necessary.
We really want to have more education and less legislation.
Homeowners are hoping the bill will come back around next year. Sherry says since these issues,
the feeling of community changed.
Kylie Kendall for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The Grand Portage Band of Lake Superior Chippewa and community members are celebrating the completion of the Hat Point Marina and Ferry Terminal in northeastern Minnesota. The upgrades mark the end of a nearly decade of work led by the Grand Portage Band. The $5.2 million project was funded through a federal grant combined with local investments. The 27-slip marina is owned and operated by the Grand Portage Band. It sits next to the Grand Portage Lodge and Casino and is centrally located on Lake Superior between Thunder Bay, Ontario, and Grand Marais.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. The alternative metal band Deftones first got together around 1988, teenage friends jamming in a garage in Sacramento, California. Now, nearly four decades later, they're out with their 10th full-length studio album. It's called Private Music. That song is called Infinite Source, and lead singer Chino Moreno says it speaks to this being somewhat of a career-defining moment for the band.
The lyric content sort of is like a reflection of the past and what we've done. I think it's the only song that really kind of done that. And the lyrics are sort of a nod to all the times and the years we spent doing this and our love for it.
Throughout their career, Deftones have consciously stretched beyond the metal genre with a list of influences as diverse as hip-hop, The Cure, and Sade. This new album, Private Music, it's no exception. Take the track Ecdysis.
This starts off with these synthesizers, this arpeggiating synthesizer, almost like in lieu of Depeche Mode type of vibes. You know, then the guitar riff comes in and it's almost like old Sepultura, even Gojira, like different sort of like, you know, the metal influences. And it wasn't done consciously. It's just like put together like bricks, you know, or like Legos even, where, you know, we were able to just like throw these random pieces together and make something cohesive out of it, which was really fun to do.
It sounds like it's really something special when all of you are able to get into the same room and engage and sort of be on the same page at the same time about music. And that, I think, it sounds like something that could be really challenging to do, particularly when we're talking about people who live all over the place, people who have been creating decades of music together. What is it like when you were in that space together, when you're able to get back there physically?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because when we first started talking about making a record, we said, all right, let's make a Dropbox folder. So the first time we get together, it's like our instinct was, okay, let's sift through the folder. What do you guys want to work on? And it was like, you know, we'd pick a couple of things and we'd work on for a minute, but it was like, now in retrospect, nothing from those folders was probably like 40 different ideas. And it's not like there weren't good ideas in there, but it was like, there's so much more special when it's like capturing the moment of us in the room at the same time, someone sparking an idea because that's where they are in that moment. And then the other members gravitating towards it. You know what I'm saying? If that made any sense.
No, that does make sense. Yeah. How do you get your energy? How do you recharge?
Man, I think in this stage of our career and our lives in general, I think that like, we've learned a better version of life-work balance. We've learned the hard way of burning ourselves out, and we've learned a good work ethic of not touring over 30 days usually. A month is usually like the longest we'll tour before we go home, and doing that 100%, you know what I mean? Like when we're home, it's like watching TV shows and having cooking and eating at home and taking the dogs for a walk. Like all that stuff is like a great balance. So then get back out here and can focus.
I understand that in the last few years, you've also quit drinking. Has that changed the way you make music or the way that you perform?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know how it was going to work, honestly. I lived the most of my adult life and, you know, actually all of my touring life of just like that being a part of just kind of what we do, you know what I mean? From having a few beers before we go on stage, loosen up, and the after party and all that stuff was always been such like a thing. I didn't really know life without it. And I never honestly really tried to not drink, but I think it became like just unhealthy, like physically, mentally. And so I just decided I want to try and see what life is like without it. And after like 30 days, I was just like, wow, just had all this clarity, was sleeping better and all this stuff. But I was like, why go back to it? Creatively, that was scary because it was like when it's time to start writing and to do whatever, like, well, I've never done it, you know, this way. So how will it be? But honestly, it was like that clarity and having that focus reigned over like any other record making process, you know what I mean, of that I've had. And it made it so much more enjoyable as well. So so it's just great to kind of, you know, to be where I'm at in this moment for that reason.
I wonder, is there a song that you feel like illustrates the sort of newfound clarity that you found?
I'd just say overall, you know, the album, I think that the songs themselves, like the fact that they're like, for the most part, the running time on all the songs sit around like between 3 and 4 minutes. There's like these concise moments that there's not so much meandering. You know what I mean? I think there is experimentation within the format of each song. I just really feel like they're concise and they're kind of to the point. It's a cohesive piece of work, but it has variety in there. And I think we knew we had a record when all those elements were sort of present.
I think one of the things that's sort of remarkable is watching the band reach this new generation of fans, some of whom are finding you on TikTok. I know that Cherry Waves went viral on the app a few years back, and now there's all these young people who will be exposed to Deftones through this new album, too. And I wonder, is there something that you hope that those fans specifically take away who maybe didn't grow up with your music, but who are going to be getting their introduction now?
I think they're already doing it. I mean, the fact that, you know, some of these songs were written before they were born, and there's something in what they're hearing that they're connecting with. When I go out there and we're performing and I'm seeing, like, fathers and daughters bonding and having this bonding moment of being at our show together, that's an awesome thing, you know what I mean? And I, you know, I can't explain it, but I do appreciate it and don't take it for granted.
Chino Moreno is the lead vocalist of Deftones. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. And from Easy Cater, a business tool for food designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at EasyCater.com. This is NPR.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in Northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Pokegama Golf Course in Grand Rapids celebrates 100 years tomorrow with live music from String Genius at 7 p.m. And Heroes Heart Rescue is holding an adoption event tomorrow at Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids. Visit with adoptable dogs and